Good morning, everybody. Good morning. If everyone could take their seats. There's some seats over here. There's a seat right there. If anyone has trouble finding a seat, let me know and I'll find you one. Anyway, it's a pleasure to have all of you here this morning. This is a very fun event for the partnership, and I'm really pleased to be able to share this all with you. I'm kind of stalling for a second as people find their way to their seats. Truly, this is, I think, a very important topic at a very critical time for our government. Before jumping in to the meat of our research findings and some of the resources that we have for all of you, I wanted to thank a lot of people who are really making this thing possible, and it's actually quite a heavy lift of work. To begin with, I want to thank our two sponsors, Monster and Aon Consulting. Monster Government Solutions, and I'm going to, if you don't mind even just standing for a second, Erica Pearson, Joyce Sassoni, Jesse Herrick, who's not here but who's their research director, and Janet Swaysland are representing Monster Government Solutions here. And thank you very much for all of your help. Please. And then likewise from Aon Consulting, Steve Kozak, Chris Mahalik, and Cecilia Evans. And I may have missed some folks from their team, but Aon and Monster were really critical for us in making this happen. We very much appreciate their support. Clearly, this stuff couldn't happen if the federal agencies that are responsible for making these projections didn't help us and were not extraordinarily cooperative. And we have a number of the people from the different agencies who helped us, and I'd like to thank them specifically. And we could hold our applause, but I do think they deserve applause. We have Abraham Nelson, from DOJ, Aaron Stupica from VA, Allison Hopkins from HUD, Rock Fowler from NSF, Rick Hastings from Treasury, Janice Guignard from Commerce, Karen Layden from FTC, Linda Irwin from Interior. And then some of the supervisors who were also extraordinarily cooperative with Ron Sanders, Reggie Wells, Sherilyn Grigsby, and we also have a good contingent from OPM, including Nancy Kishak. So a big round of applause to all of them, please. And honestly, I apologize if I've forgotten anybody who is here with us. There are clearly a lot of other people from the federal government side that were instrumental in making this project work. And I really do think it's important to take this moment to thank them because there's a lot of time and effort that goes in this kind of work that oftentimes does get unrecognized, but actually I think has extraordinary impact. On the thank you side, I have to close with some folks from the partnership because this wouldn't have happened without them, and I'm only saying what they tell me to say, so it's really, I have the easiest job of everybody here. But from our research team to begin with, we have Bob Lavinia, who's our research director, who's standing in back there, someone who is not here but was the day-to-day person who knocked on every one of these doors, Tally Stepp, who used to be at the Department of Labor, and this is her third time actually making this project run. We have Jonathan Kapler, who's nodding his head right there. For those of you who were able to come to our SES event, you will recognize him as the gentleman who took point on that event, and you may wonder how he can be here again, having taken point on this project a mere 10 days later. And I asked the same question. I don't know, but he did. And a great deal. Thank you to Jonathan. All the good work is made beautiful by an incredible communications team that we have. And I don't often get to thank Laura Shane, who is our communications director, but I will, and she's standing right there. And you'll see Bevan Johnston is our webmaster, graphic design. Chief, and you'll see when you get a chance to look at the website, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, how incredible her work really is. So, again, there are a lot of other folks from the partnership side that are involved in this process, and I really do want to thank all of them for their incredible work. So let's talk about what we found here and why we believe this work is so important. The starting point from our end is that we think that there is a unique moment in time for the federal government to restock its talent, not only for today, but for tomorrow. We have a unique moment, not only because of the jobs that have to be filled, but also because a talent market that is primed and ready and interested in the possibility of coming into government service. And that's a big change. We have a talent market that, by and large, is historically, in at least recent times, not seeing government service as part of public service. But that's changing. We have a president who has made it a priority to make government cool again. We have a government that has become central to you know, so many of the critical issues that we face in our country. And obviously we have you know, economic challenges that make people look around a little bit more for job opportunities. But on that latter point, I think it's worth stressing that the best talent will always have options. And it's real important for, you know, I think for the federal government not to make the mistake of believing that, you know, increased numbers means that they're either reaching their full potential or really getting the best talent. The second key element, I think, about this report and why it's important is captured in the second statement. And I am accused, and I think quite fairly sometimes, about operating under a ready, fire, aim, you know, posture. And obviously not always the best. I go off without having prepared as much as I ought to. And our view is that the federal government ought not to make my mistake. And we ought to see the federal government starting with the workforce planning that really ought to be the beginning point for its talent management process. And the Where the Jobs Are report is an effort to try to bring forward that workforce planning effort holistically in government in a helpful way. And it is one step. We are trying to keep, we're continually improving it, and it has a lot more work to be done with it. But we think that ready, aim, fire mentality is something that is vital, especially when we think about the long-term talent needs of government. So what do we do? And in one sense, there's a very simple way of capturing it. And I mentioned Tally Stepp knocking on doors. Well, she literally phoned, emailed, pestered, harassed, you know, whatever it took, 35 different federal agencies that represent about 99% of the federal workforce, asking them for their workforce projections, working with them to get them. And in this instance, we did it in an online fashion that I think enabled it to be a lot easier. And truthfully, you know, we found, you know, different response from different folks. And some agencies were, you know, ready to go, had all this information. Some did not. Some, you know, we really actually had to help do actual projections from prior hiring. The point here is this is work that obviously needs to be done by every agency, but I think collectively brought together as well. And these jobs are what are described as mission critical positions. And that definition is one that is held by the individual agency in defining their own particular talent needs. And so a nice example that Jonathan gave once, which I like a lot, is, you know, if you're an archivist, you know, the archivist position is something that the National Archives, you might imagine, would be a mission-critical position. But there are plenty of other agencies which might not view, you know, archivists as mission-critical. And the point here is that this is not one-size-fits-all. We have to really look at the talent from the perspective of the organization that needs it. And these jobs are the heart of what needs to happen. So our top line finding then is that in total there are 273,000 mission critical positions that need to be filled in the next 3 years. And this is a 41% increase from the last time we engaged in this exercise, which was 2 years ago. So it's a very large increase. It involved jobs across the country, all types of occupations, although it's concentrated in five particular categories, which we'll talk about in a minute. If I ask you to do anything once you leave this place, is go to the website and take a look at wherethejobsare.org. And I'm going to give you a few screenshots because I'm assured by the amazing Bevan Johnson that it's a big mistake to try to do this live here. But please do take a look at the website because I am not doing it justice with these screenshots. There is so much information of value and of use, and I think you will find it quite neat for a variety of reasons, which I'm going to go through in a second. But to begin with, this is an innovation on our side. This is the third iteration of our Where the Jobs Are report. The first two involved putting together a 100-plus page, you know, I wouldn't call it phone book, but pretty large you know, a booklet of jobs that that went off the shelf in the thousands. And it was a very good product, I think, but nowhere close to as useful as having all this information findable and sortable through the web. And so we decided to save some trees and to make it a better product by moving to the web, which you'll see when you go to your computer how wonderful it is. So here's what you see when you get there. This is the home page, and if you look at the top, I think one of the important points here is that we think this product actually has a number of different audiences. Clearly, the job seeker, and you'll note the tab for job seekers. Agencies as well. We think universities will find this quite useful because they need to be thinking about, you know, how they're preparing their students for the work environment and what kind of demands are going to be in jobs. Clearly, I think policymakers need to be viewing this. Agencies from the perspective of thinking about opportunities for collaborative action. So in addition to the different tabs that you saw on the top, we have the five main buckets of concentrated government hiring. And you'll notice both the number and then also the buckets. Taking in the number one spot is the medical and public health area. Number two, security and protection. Three, compliance and enforcement. Four, legal having moved up from number nine in our last ranking. And then program management and administration, number five. And you'll note that you're able to see the full buckets by simply clicking on them from this page. On the left-hand side, I think very importantly, you'll notice that the jobs are sorted also by professional field. And frankly, for the job seeker, this is the most useful piece. Job seekers are interested in finding out what kind of jobs that might be available to them according to their occupation. And one mistake I think government has historically made is to approach the talent market from the perspective of its own organizational form. Come work for the Department of Energy. When in fact, what they're really interested in is finding out opportunities to be engineers or to be IT professionals in any number of different federal agencies. And I think, again, the data is organized in a way that's going to be attractive to them. So then what happens when you start looking at individual buckets? If you take an example here, the security and protection hiring projections that you'll note up here, we provide a variety of different pieces of information. The first general tab you'll see says number of employees as of September 30th, 08, total number of hires, and then the projected hires, which then if you add up, obviously, lead up to the full bucket numbers. And this is broken down by agency. You can obviously click on any individual agency and get to their hiring projections. You can look across any of the job categories as well. But this is just part of the show because you also, in addition to having the general tab, you have the turnover tab, which tells you the number of folks that have left those positions in the last year, the average age, retirement eligibility as of today, and the retirement eligibility as of 2012. So again, this is a very, very deep data set. A lot of information is here. Even more attractive, I think, if you go down further on the page, you'll see a bunch of other information about the agencies that are doing the hiring in the particular bucket that you're looking at. So again, security and protection, you know, top agency, great surprise, DHS, the number of jobs that you have there, but also then tells you where those jobs are physically located graphically on a map of the United States. The jobs as of today, those are not the projected jobs, just to be clear, because we can't do that. But it tells you, you know, gives you a baseline about where the positions are as of this moment. Here is an example of additional information from the Department of Justice page if you were to go to an individual agency. So agencies, in addition to providing information about their specific hiring needs, also included information in their responses to us about their recruitment programs that they're using, the outreach efforts that they're doing, bonuses and student loan repayment, and some other information that I think is quite valuable. The other point I would add is that I think extraordinarily important, we have tied this website to the Best Places to Work website. So if a job seeker is interested in a particular profession, they can find out where those jobs are and then get a pretty good bead on what it's like to work in that particular agency or subcomponent. And I think that integration is one of the biggest innovations that we have with the Where the Jobs Are report, and I think will be extraordinarily valuable for job seekers. And I hope, again, that you'll examine this. I had a meeting yesterday at an agency that I cannot reveal the identity of the agency, but where their senior manager said, "I understand why you did it, but did you have to do that for our agency?" And it was a little bit tongue in cheek, obviously, but I mean, truth be told, we believe that our messaging is extraordinarily positive for everybody about the value of public service. And clearly, agencies that are higher ranked have that advantage. But I think that the opportunity for everybody is quite large here to open up, to make transparent the information about government jobs in a way that I think is desperately needed. So moving on, this is just the DOJ page again, so you can see what it looks like. So we do it by occupational category, but also by agency. What kind of hiring is done here, and then also where the positions are located and some demographic information. Now, very importantly, you'll notice, again, one of the, I think, really important innovations here, the bar up on top, the USA Jobs bar. One of the things that we did is tie this site into USA Jobs so that somebody who is, again, interested in a job, say, as an accountant or whatever it might be, or in this instance, as justice, we have an IT management position that's located on the bar up there, the search bar. They can find out what opportunities there might be in government. They can find out what agencies are hiring, what they're like. And then they can find out what specific jobs are available right now simply by clicking on the search button there for USA Jobs. And then, voila, they find out, IT specialists, they find all the positions that are available. So we have, in essence, integrated in the opportunity to learn about agencies, to find specific jobs, and I think this is pretty cool. So I really, we have a long ways to go, but I think this is a very big step forward. So finally, we have some other general information for job seekers about how to navigate the environment, the federal hiring process, and a variety of other resources on the website, again, that I think if you have a moment and can tool around, you'll be quite pleased to see what you find. That's the website. And then I think it's also important to talk a little bit about the context because, in this environment, on one hand, one can see this as an opportunity, but there's also the risk that, some people, I think, misread and misunderstand what we're presenting here and make the argument that, boy, government is growing like crazy. Isn't that a real problem? And the answer is no. In fact, it's not growing like crazy, and it's not a real problem. And indeed, this is, I think, little-known information, but we're looking in absolute terms at a government headcount even after these hires that will be no larger than a government was in 1967. We're looking at a government that has, in fact, by headcount, not grown, and if anything, has declined in numbers for quite a substantial period of time. And then if you think in relative terms, government has actually shrunk. The percentage of the workforce that is in the federal workforce has declined. And I think that's an important message point that needs to be communicated in this context. But what is, in fact, driving these hiring numbers? What's driving the 41% increase? And I think there are four important factors that are captured here. First of all, the government has, and I'm going to take these in a slightly different order than you have here, only because I want to do them, and I think in the order of where they're most prominent. And that is, there's the clear message about having to address the attrition that's occurring in government, largely due to retirement. Lots of folks are leaving, despite the economic downturn. We're still seeing large numbers of folks who are retirement eligible, who are taking retirement, and we got to replace those people. Secondly, we have a situation where there's a lot of pent-up demand. There are agencies that, again, have been flatlined or have seen their workforces decline, and the new administration has understood that that's a real problem and is, at least now, and I hope going forward, offering the opportunity to fill jobs that have needed filling. And that includes in agencies like Social Security Administration, where you obviously have an enormous workload that's been increasing due to the baby boomer retirements and a workforce that has not kept up to that increased demand. And so that pent-up demand is partly responsible for some of the increases that we're seeing here. Third, clearly we have new issues of need that the government is having to address. Now, whether that's the financial meltdown or two wars that we are fighting or global warming, there are a lot of things that government is being asked to do that's new and then obviously requires additional talent. And then fourth and finally, and this is something that I don't think is reflected fully in the numbers that we have here already, but there's a question of insourcing. The question of trying to take some functions that have been contracted out and bringing them back into the federal fold, and probably most notably is the issue of the acquisition workforce. But I think those are the four drivers of the talent needs that we're seeing here. And again, in context, we're not really talking about a substantial or any real increase historically in the actual headcount size of government. As I mentioned at the front end about the Ready, Aim, Fire. This is part of a continuum of effort, we believe, when you're talking about talent management. Your workforce planning should be the starting point. But it's not. It is one piece of the puzzle. We have to be thinking about, you know, how we're recruiting and hiring, how we're onboarding the talent, how we're developing our existing talent so we retain it, succession planning. All those things are tied together, and it's a system that needs tending across its full spectrum. And we believe this is an important starting point, the workforce planning side, but it's by no means the end of the story. And that larger context, I think, needs to be addressed more fully. So that is a maybe not so quick, but a rundown of what we've got here. I think it's going to be a great resource. We want it to be even better. So when you have ideas or thoughts about things that we might include or do better, please let me know. And I am now very pleased to be able to welcome some folks to the stage who know a lot more about this than I do. And I'm looking forward to a conversation with them. So we have Mary Barsantangelo, who is here from the Department of Justice. Please come on up. Rochelle Granite from the Department of Treasury, and Jeff Neal from the Department of Homeland Security, all three of whom represent the three of the five or six, I'm trying to remember now, largest, demands on the demand side, agencies with the largest demand for new hires. They all are extraordinarily accomplished individuals who are leading the human capital charge in their agencies, and I'm very pleased to have them here. So let us begin with a round of applause for the three of them. We were going to open this all up to questions from you, but I'm going to kick things off. Please, we have a microphone, and I'd appreciate it if you would, Jim Seymour, who is responsible for our Service to America medals and all of our events like this, has that microphone back there. But please wait a second when you raise your hand so they can give it to you so that we can capture this for some of the media and other folks that are here in the room. But let me start off by just asking the three folks that we have here, what opportunities are there for collaborative action among the agencies to recruit talent? Because I think, again, this is typically viewed as an agency-by-agency exercise, and I'm wondering if you think there are opportunities to work more together. And whoever wants to jump in.
Well, I'd be happy to. I think there's tremendous opportunities for agencies to work together. There are a number of occupations that cross all of our agencies, certainly the mission support occupations, which are critical to any agency functioning. We've done a number of things lately, certainly participating in joint job fairs. There was recently a job fair in Detroit that OPM sponsored that many of us made certain we were represented at, and that was very successful for that arena. We've worked with the partnership a fair amount in ensuring that we take advantage of things across the government and with the partnership. And just as one example, the recent intern event where Treasury participated with the partnership in educating interns about how to apply for government jobs. And we weren't just doing it for Treasury. We were doing it for the entire government.
I would echo that. OPM has been a good leader in this area as well. Acquisition is a good example of how we're looking across government and not just per agency. That's a very wise way to pursue our talent, and I think a very welcoming way for new talent to take a look at us as government, as an employer, versus each particular agency. Human resources is another area I think that we've been talking about for some time, and we're looking at it again in terms of the loss of talent there and reinvigorating that group as well. So there are many areas for collaboration.
Right. Jeff, anything?
Yeah, I think one of the most important ones is to help show people that working for the federal government is public service. The organization that's hosting this is the Partnership for Public Service, not the Partnership for Federal Employment. And the people who come to work for our organizations, particularly at the Department of Homeland Security, the people who come to work for us come because of the mission and come because of the public service aspects of what they do. And we need to work together to make certain that we keep reinforcing the idea of public service And that's what you actually end up with when you go to work for one of our organizations.
Excellent. Jeff, I can't resist telling a very quick story. Our name originally, when we first started over 8 years ago, was the Campaign for Public Service. And then we tested it, and we found that in a bunch of focus groups, we were testing a lot of other things, perceptions about government, but we, at the end, asked people about the name. And they hated the word campaign. And they hated it because they thought it meant money, it meant short-term, and I have long-term focus. So we decided to ditch that and say partnership. But they also, to a single person, none of them viewed government service as public service. And so we were faced with the option, well, do we call it partnership for government service? But we ultimately said, makes sense to get rid of the word campaign, but we need actually, the ideal has to be to connect government service back to public service. So we have to hold on to that ideal. And that's why we kept the name as we did. So just a quick aside there. When you're thinking about the individual candidates, you know, in today's world, what kind of talent government really needs? Are there qualities, you know, beyond, you know, the technical expertise that you think are important to find in people who are applying for government jobs? And if so, if I can add one little twist on that too, what can agencies do to assess for that or identify and choose for that?
We at the Department of Justice have about 108,000 employees, and just to give you a little bit of background, because some of you already know this and some don't, but we have very exciting work, and people want to work with the Department of Justice, and the kinds of skills that they need are basic communication skills, analytical thinking skills. You know, in this time in government, I think you need strength of character and integrity to work for the federal service, and those are things that we look for.
I would concur with that, certainly. I think we need to be and we should be looking for a commitment to public service and an understanding of what the work ethic in that regard and the ethics generally are in that, and a flexibility in terms of the environment, and obviously we're talking across many diverse occupations and many different organizations that have very different cultures, but I think there's certainly commonality in the commitment to public service, the desire to learn and grow, which of course really requires us to make sure that we are investing in that, in development of our employees, but and a sense of personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. Communication, I would say, is the other thing that we really need to focus on, because if we don't have folks who are able to communicate orally and in writing in a way that will ensure that they're able to communicate with the public or their other customers, and really be dedicated to customer service, communication competency is very, very important.
We, in the Department of Homeland Security, are a rather large department. We have, counting the Coast Guard and the civilian employees, about 215,000 people working every day in our department. We're looking for a diverse group of people who are representative of the country that we protect, looking for folks who have the dedication to the mission that our employees have right now. One of the things that we view as a strong suit of our department is that mission commitment. And you find it over and over again when you talk to people on the front lines in DHS. We are looking for people who have practically every skill that was on those charts that Max was showing a few minutes ago. When you look at the five areas, the five occupational areas, we employ people in every one of those areas. So it's a very broad department with a lot of various types of jobs. You can do just about anything you want in the Department of Homeland Security as far as type of occupation goes. We're also looking for people who aren't used to status quo. I mean, we're a department that is still evolving. We're still doing a lot of work to unify the department, to build a much more efficient Department of Homeland Security. And so we're not looking for folks who want to come in and just sit back and relax. We want folks who want to come in, roll up their sleeves, and get to work. And right now on the USA Jobs list, which Max pointed to a few minutes ago, there are more than 500 vacancy announcements from the Department of Homeland Security. So we are open for business right now and looking for folks every day.
I want to make sure that there's an opportunity for folks here to ask a question, and I will keep going until I see. Please.
Steve Losey with the Federal Times newspaper. One thing that this report details that Max mentioned is the large increase in the number of legal jobs that you'll be expecting to hire. A large part of that is due to an increase in veterans claims examiners, but there's also increases in the numbers of attorneys and so on and so forth. What do you think is driving that? Is it primarily an increase in expected retirements, or do you expect to be broadening the number of legal jobs you'll be expecting to do? What's driving that, and what might some of the challenges be in recruiting for those positions?
Well, at Justice, we have almost 4,000 jobs that we're projecting for 2010, and some of those jobs are attorneys, they're law enforcement, correctional officers, but when you're asking about these large numbers that are in Max's report, those are primarily driven by the normal churn of retirement, and by replacement, turnover, and some growth. And I think, like Max said very well earlier, we do have new challenges, and we do have new areas that our president and Congress are asking us to look into. So we also have to forecast and spend some time looking at what we need to have the best and the brightest. In the legal area, we have, for example, Civil Rights Division has about 102 positions. It's an 18% increase an 18% increase in the 2010 budget. And for just as an example of those 102 positions, a little over 50, almost 55 of those are attorneys. And we'll have a number of attorneys in the coming years as well.
I would. Since justice is a little bit of a different animal, because most
we are
such a significant portion of their workforce are attorneys, in agencies where that's not the case, certainly as programs grow in their mission or in volume, attorneys as a mission support, as a support function, naturally grow just like other mission support. Programs grow, so that accounts for some level of the increase. For example, at the Internal Revenue Service, there's been a very recent, as in right this minute, increase in the number of revenue agents. That generates more work for the attorneys as they work with a higher volume of cases that come to them because of the higher volume of activity. And then again, there's also new programs at Treasury in terms of the Office of Financial Stability. We have new programs that requires additional legal resources in terms of implementing those according to the new legislation.
Please, question right here. Hi, I'm Charles Biberman, just a potential job seeker. I'm wondering if you could comment two things. One, I've heard about events that are called hiring events, where agencies, recruiters actually have the capability to make a hiring decision pending some sort of background check. I'm wondering if you could speak to those. I know there's an event next week in Tyson's Corner. I'm going to be going to that. And secondly, apparently there are some in the job descriptions, it indicates quick hire, which apparently they're a little more accelerated hiring decisions, and I'm wondering if there's any way to sort of filter for that or search for those so-called quick hire positions. Thank you.
There are a couple of things to look at in that. One is you may see the actual term quick hire, which is a product name. It's a piece of software that some federal agencies use. You'll also see the term direct hire. Direct hire is a streamlined hiring process that allows us to do hiring in a more conventional way, the way we might do if we were USA Incorporated, where we get resumes, assess qualifications, and then just make an offer to someone. So direct hire is a faster and easier way to fill federal jobs. And It actually, I think, gets into one of the issues that we need to deal with as a federal government, and that's the hiring process itself. As a federal job seeker, you probably have found that the process isn't exactly simple and easy and intuitive and self-explanatory. Most people find that. Our hiring process is sometimes a barrier to getting people into the federal government and filling our jobs. So we do need to do a lot to streamline that hiring process, to get rid of 15-page vacancy announcements that turn people off when they read them, to make the hiring process simpler, where you can submit a resume instead of writing a lengthy application. There's a lot of work going on in the various departments and with the Office of Personnel Management right now. The director of OPM, John Berry, has assembled a team of people to go after this issue of hiring reform. And I think that's one of the areas that all of us have to devote a lot of energy to over the next few months, to make certain this process is easier, to make the process more focused on the outcomes and less focused on a prescribed, detailed, rather bureaucratic process to get people into the federal government. And when we do that, it will make filling these positions, 65,000 of which we have to fill in DHS, it will make filling them a lot easier and make it much easier for someone like you who's looking for work to be able to get into one of the jobs in the government that, that you're well qualified for.
If I could add to that, I've been in federal government for 16 years, and I still try to look at it as an outsider. And I know that sometimes when you look at the federal job announcements, they almost look like they're written in code. Does that sound familiar? There are a number of things that we have to have by law in the job descriptions, but I think that, what my colleague from DHS mentioned in terms of the SWAT teams that OPM is leading, we're really looking to ensure that those job descriptions are much shorter. At Justice, we're looking at, you know, 3 to 5 pages and trying to do links, because all of our new job seekers are so familiar with links, and there's such an ease in using that. And we're trying to put them in plain English so that you, as a new job seeker, understand what we're asking for. It's not written in federal code, but it's written in a language that you can understand.
And also, just one thing I'm happy with, it, a lot of very useful information. The one thing I got to underscore is the use of the term job announcement, which I think is wonderful, because, you know, federal speak talks about vacancy announcements. Mm-hmm. No need to do that. Vacancy doesn't seem all that attractive. So I think it's great that was, you know, not, that's not a term used by staff, required by statute. So I think that's actually quite terrific.
Yeah, no one goes out and tells their friends, hey, I got a vacancy today.
Exactly right. All right, another question here, Paul.
Hello, my name is Paul Rouse, and I'm with World at Work. It's a global human resource association that focuses on helping organizations attract, motivate, and retain talent. And the gentleman here actually stole a large part of my question, because you've got incredible supply and pent-up demand. The question is, how do you get throughput through the pipeline? But that draws me to the real question of, what are some of the other stones in the road that you see? I noticed from a rough count that you've got about 30% of your human resource workforce needs to be replaced. And what are you looking for in that type of talent? And how are you going to bring them on board and introduce them into this culture change?
I'd be happy to address that, since Treasury is very involved in working on transforming the human capital occupation. And this is critical not just for the human capital occupation, but it's critical for being able to help our agencies meet their mission by hiring the right people at the right time with the right advanced workforce planning. And this is an occupation that has been unfortunately neglected over the recent years. And we really need folks to focus on being strategic business partners with hiring managers and senior leadership of the agency to do that really critical workforce planning, to do that strategy around what are the critical things we need and how do we go out and find that talent. It's not simply posting a job announcement on USA Jobs. And it's not simply speeding up the process. We can't go for speed without going, ensuring that we're getting the quality we need. And that really requires talented human capital professionals who have the competencies to do strategic thinking, strong workforce analysis, and can work closely with the hiring managers and leadership to identify the talent and identify the ways to reach that talent, not simply by posting vacancy announcements. And that requires training, significant training. It's investing in the current workforce. Most importantly, it's also investing in the future human capital workforce.
And a critical piece of, because the HR professional, like Rochelle said, absolutely needs to know their business. They need to have all of the background and the critical skills and the critical analytical and thinking skills, but they also need to know how to talk to managers. They need to know how to talk to employees. So that, again, it's communication, speaking English, not HREs, but English to our customers, the managers, the potential employees, the applicants, our current employees. Those are very important skills.
I cannot resist making a shameless plug here. Within the Office of the Chief Human Capital Officer at DHS, we are in the beginning stages of a hiring effort to beef up our staff. And in about 3 weeks, we will be advertising more than 50 HR vacancies within our headquarters HR shop. And so for folks who are in the human capital business, we have some great opportunities at DHS right now. And all of our components are also hiring in the human capital area. So it's a great place to work for a human capital professional. And we have some great opportunities to do really interesting work over the next few years.
Hi, Alan Moore. I'm the employer in residence at George Mason University for U.S. Government Programs. I'm a retired Fed. I spent 33 years in the intelligence community, and two of those were in recruiting. A statement perhaps you can react to. You have a daunting task here, and we at the university have a lot of people who are very, very interested in the federal government. We're 3 days into the semester here, and I've been inundated with emails, and so have my fellow career counselors. One of the issues that we find with federal agencies too often is one part of one agency will come out, and all three of you have agencies that have numerous other bureaus, and I'm not going to put my finger, but sometimes come out with one person recruiting for one profession. I don't know anything about the other agencies. And I encourage you folks to look at some sort of a centralized hiring mechanism. I'm really glad to hear DHS is getting more HR officers, and come out and be able to talk about all the professions out there. And this is something that students can get frustrated with, is talking to one element that doesn't know what the other 10 elements are doing. And you're shaking your head from Treasury, because I worked at Treasury for a while and I know how it is. Thank you.
That's one of the things I think that probably all of us are addressing right now, is the we have bureau or component structures that are there for a reason, and they do have some very strong benefits having that kind of structure. But we also are all part of a single department in DHS. We have a lot of components, and we have one Department of Homeland Security. So what we're doing is working to with our components to build more professional recruiting staffs and to make certain that when we're out recruiting, we're recruiting for DHS. We're not recruiting just for a single component. The person who may not be interested in being on the border might very well be interested in working in an airport. They might be interested in working here in Washington or somewhere else where we have a large presence, Detroit, for example. So we need to make certain we're not losing that talent. And that type of stovepipe approach to recruiting absolutely is a way to turn off talent and to lose talent. So I think we're working on that one very hard right now. It's a real issue.
We got a bunch of questions, so let's go with Zach there.
Thanks, Max. It's Max Takis from Federal News Radio and WTOP Radio. If I go back to the radio, the two radio stations I worked for this afternoon and put this story on the air, inevitably the phone call or the email that I'm going to get is, oh, how do I apply for these jobs? And at the risk of piling on the subject of the hiring process, two parts. What words of hope would you have to the applicant who is having to deal with the status quo hiring process right now, who wants a job with your agencies and who wants to work for the federal government, who feels that sense of mission, but they would like to get a job sooner than later because of the situation? And what can you tell us about where changes and improvements to the hiring process are going to go based on your work with John Berry? Nancy Kichak is here in the audience today. What can you tell us about how much better the hiring process is going to be in the future? Thank you.
I'll take it. I've been involved in this hiring process for a very long time, and I've seen it run very smoothly, and I've seen it run less than smoothly. What we have to do right now, for people who are looking today, they need to be persistent. The federal job process today isn't an ideal process, but the jobs are there. And in this economy, we're able to offer very good employment, public service jobs with good benefits, good working conditions. We offer telework. We offer flexible work schedules. We have fitness centers in many of our facilities. We have child care in many of our facilities. We are a very good employer, and the worst of federal employers is probably better than a lot of private sector employers in all the benefits that we offer to our workforce, because we want to be a model for what a workplace should be. So I would encourage people to stick with it right now, even though the process is a cumbersome process. And while they're sticking with it, we're working on fixing it. We're working on reducing the need for lengthy applications. Right now, federal applications are frequently 10 or 15 or 20 or more pages. My all-time record for an application I received was one that was 500 pages long. So it came in a box that a ream of paper came in. I don't understand why they did that, but they did. We want them to be resumes. We want people to be able to take a resume that they would use to apply for a position at IBM and use that to apply at DHS or Justice or Treasury or anywhere else in the government. We want them to look at a vacancy announcement that says, this job is this, not that gives you 15 or 16 or more pages of text that you have to read through. If it takes you 2 hours to read the vacancy announcement and figure it all out, that's not good. And so we're working on fixing those right now. We're mapping out the hiring processes to look at where there are problems in the processes. You know, when you lay a process out from end to end, you find all kinds of things that you don't necessarily find when you're just operating the process. All the agencies are doing that right now, too, as a part of this effort with OPM. So I'm really confident that within a few months we will have some very good ideas in place to actually streamline the hiring process and make it easier for people to apply for jobs. At the same time, a number of us are going to be, I think, talking to OPM about other options that we have, such as increased direct hire authority, to make it easier to get people into these mission-critical occupations right now. DHS, for example, right now is looking for people who have a cybersecurity background. I don't want to have to find somebody who's got that type of high-demand background and say, by the way, here's the 16-page vacancy announcement, here's the 10-page job application you have to fill out. Go ahead and have at it. I need to be able, when I find folks like that, to say, you look like you'd be great for DHS. When can you start? So that's really what we have to be able to do.
And the encouraging piece about the changes to me, working with OPM and OMB, is that we're really paying attention to that in a collaborative way, not just OPM or OMB. We're working together. And the other piece about that is sometimes we in the past have been given direction and then we had to meet a certain way to make that happen and spent our time in bureaucratic administrative processes. And honestly, I think the SWAT team process from OPM right now is looking to find these best practices and then put them into action now. Don't wait until you've passed a certain check mark or approach, but to actually do them and get the word out to you quickly.
We have a whole bunch of questions. We're going to take some more. I just wanted to take a quick spin at this one as well, because I think you heard some very important words about what's going to be happening and the efforts to change. I think that Jeff has said something very important at the front end about, you know, what's the advice for someone looking today and the word patience was where he started, and I fully subscribe to that. I believe patience is an undervalued virtue, and in the federal hiring process, it's both necessary and will lead you ultimately to success. I also think it's important. We have a set of resources on makingthedifference.org that sort of help folks through the present process. But having a lot of irons in the fire, not just relying simply on the internet, but looking for people to talk to, finding a human being that you can actually communicate with. And for those from within government here today, I would, not that you're not already thinking about this, but to the extent in that you can help put out the word that everyone ought to be helping in this way. And it doesn't have to just be the HR folks, but the program people, because having that human contact is so important. And I think the risk here is that you have a set of folks primed to enter in public service, and if they run into that brick wall, it reinforces a negative stereotype that we don't need reinforced, and it has a ripple effect as well. So, the short term, making sure we have that human contact. We have a bunch of questions. Jim is the man at the microphone, so go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Carol Lieber. I'm Director of Human Resource Policy at the Environmental Protection Agency. First, I'd like to say to the job seeker, and if there are others in the room, I'd be more than happy to stay behind to talk to you about what opportunities might be available at EPA. But the question that I have for the panel is, I was contacted last week by someone who's very interested in working for the federal government, and she's a firefighter. And because she's a firefighter, she works 10 days per month. So she's finding herself with a lot of extra time on her hand. She has a lot of passion for what she does. She loves her job, so she doesn't necessarily want to leave. But she has a lot of skills that I think would be very useful in the government, particularly in Department of Homeland Security. She's hazmat trained and all of those good things. So she was asking me about what opportunities might exist in the federal government. And I hadn't really thought about people who were in that category who are looking for jobs as maybe kind of a hidden job market for people who are looking for a flexible schedule. But that's probably a little bit more flexible than what we have available at EPA, because she can't really do part-time job sharing. She doesn't know what her schedule is necessarily I think she probably knows 2 weeks in advance. But I'm just curious if there are any efforts going on at your agency to also try to tap into that job market, that talent pool that might have the skill sets that you need for some of your critical vacancies but might not necessarily be able to work in the traditional work schedule that we have in the government.
We have a lot of part-time employees in DHS, particularly in the Transportation Security Administration. A lot of our transportation security officers, folks you see at the airports all the time, are working part-time jobs. So we have a mix of part-time and full-time and occupations like that. The one thing in a case like that would probably be a real difficulty is having another job that's the primary job and having to have the schedule be dependent on that. Given the type of work we do, schedules are really important to us, and we have to be able to rely on somebody to be available when we need them, and so that probably in a case like that would get in the way. But we do have a lot of part-time opportunities. We have a lot of folks who come to work for us part-time.
Hello, my name is Chris McConnell with GovCentral. I wanted to speak to some of the findings in the report. One was saying that 75% of those federal employees have some sort of secondary education, college education. I sort of wanted to wonder, one, where, what sort of skills should college students be looking for, or two, what sort of programs should they be looking at?
Well, obviously it depends on what occupation they're... Well, I would say certainly if you're talking about sort of the general workforce, your general liberal arts skills, but writing and communication, as I think I said earlier, is really, really critical, and I'd say that goes across the spectrum. Obviously, if they have an interest in IT, that's naturally what they'd be focusing on. There are those who focus on public policy programs. Gives them a general background. Analytic things that give them analytic skills is also extremely useful in those general job areas if you're not focusing on a particular profession. or discipline?
If someone is, for example, is in a business-related program, a business degree is a great entree into contracting positions. Acquisition-related positions are a big growth area in the federal government right now, partly because of contractor conversions. I know within DHS we're going to be hiring a lot of folks. DOD is going to be hiring thousands of contract specialists. They're looking for people who have at least 24 semester hours of business-related courses to go into that type of position. So business-related programs are always very helpful in going into federal employment.
And I should, I'm sorry. I should add, the fact that that significant percentage of the federal workforce have college degrees doesn't mean that there is a positive, an education requirement for a lot of positions. There are many positions in the federal government that don't necessarily require the degree, but we are fortunate that good portion of the workforce, of the folks who are interested in federal employment, do have that higher education.
And for people who do come to work for us without a degree or who come to work with a bachelor's degree and would like to get a master's degree, all of us have tuition assistance programs to be able to help encourage folks to go to school while they're working. So we have a lot of folks who come to work with us with no degree or with one level of education and over time earn a degree or earn another degree through our tuition assistance programs.
And one of the things that I look for that's more general and may not be a skill that you learn in school, but one that you can apply to almost any job, and that is taking initiative, doing your best work, striving for excellence, seeking a mentor of someone who can help you learn and model those kinds of skills. No matter what job we're looking for at Justice, we're looking for people that don't do just good enough work, people that are really working hard, and people that are striving for excellence. That taking initiative, doing what it takes, is a skill that will drive you far in any job. And I think we need to pay attention to those kinds of strength of character types of skills.
Wendy Perry, University of Virginia. I'm the director of professional development programs at the graduate and postdoctoral levels. And one function I was surprised not to see in any of these categories is research, although I was under the impression that that was a priority for this administration. And so I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that. And at the same time, do you have any idea of the portion of these opportunities that would be attractive to candidates at the advanced degree level, particularly the PhD level? And do you see these opportunities? Would you encourage them to look to the federal government? I didn't see much there in the materials that I picked up today at that level. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that, and particularly research.
The federal government actually has a lot of people who are involved in research, National Institutes for Health, for example. In the Washington, D.C. area, just across, just down the river from us, is the Naval Research Lab. Very highly regarded facility. Has had several folks from there win the Nobel Prize for work that they did at the Naval Research Lab doing basic research. And it's hard to find places where you can actually do basic research and not have the pressure of getting a product out.
The answer is that there are a lot of needs, and so what we're capturing are the highest volume needs. And I think that there are two pieces to the question. I think Jeff hits one of them, which is that there's no institution that does more research across the science and engineering fields than the federal government. And that's you heard a few examples, but there are a ton of them. If you come to our Service to America Medals program later on in September, you'll see a number of incredible scientists, and they've consistently get recognized. There are also, and I think equally important, a lot of opportunities for those folks who have PhDs to do things that are not direct pure research positions, but nonetheless can apply, whether you have a doctorate in philosophy or a doctorate in physics, apply your knowledge into some of the programmatic areas that federal agencies touch. And truly, just about, if not every federal agency has needs that would match and fit those kinds of skills and experiences. There's not a particular bucket, in part because you're talking about very large concentrations around like the security and enforcement area where you're talking 50, 60,000 jobs. But sprinkled throughout that, you'll have a lot of those. And if you go to the website, you'll have much better smaller bite-sized pieces of looking through what the kinds of opportunities there are. But for sure, I hope you will inform your students. And one of the great challenges, again, is that this is not on the radar screen for a lot of people. And what we really need to make sure happens is that the best talent understand that they really do have these incredible opportunities. And it's, if you're a a math major, in fact, NSA is your number one, choice for employment. If you're an engineer, NASA is going to be top up there. But there are a whole bunch of different organizations within the federal government that ought to have equivalent brand recognition in the talent market that don't. And I think your being here is to be commended, so that you can share that information with those that you're taking care of. We're going to, I think, take two more questions, and we've got one right here.
Good morning. My name is Rick Heron. I'm the director of the University Career Center and the President's Promise at the University of Maryland. Just wondering if you can comment on where internships fit within this grand scheme.
Internships are a huge focus of a lot of the agencies, Treasury included, in that that's our ability to reach out and grab folks early in their development while they're in school, and hopefully that we provide them an experience that encourages them to look to the federal government, and in Treasury's case, we hope to Treasury for future employment. And we've been very successful in engaging many, many interns each summer and throughout the year. It's a way to be able to do the kind of outreach that at early stages that we can't do as well through the regular hiring process. We've worked, and it helps in terms of our diversity outreach. We're able to focus some of those opportunities in ways that ensure that we are getting a pool of interested young people from the most diverse pool to be encouraged to work within the federal government and see the federal government as a great place to work.
And internships are an incredible important tool in terms of not only our being able to attract you to look at our department and look at various jobs that we have. We have hundreds and hundreds of interns during the summer and throughout the year. And it's also a chance for you to sort of dip your toe in the public service and see what it's like. And to have a sense of all the different kinds of jobs that exist not only within a particular department but across federal government. So that's an excellent tool, particularly while you're in school.
I would just add that they're also great ambassadors because they come back, they go back to school and they talk about their experience, and they encourage other students to look at that the next summer during the school year.
There are a couple of broad categories of internships. We have folks who are in intern programs where they come to an agency, work for a few months, and then go back to school. We also have internships where people are hired into entry-level positions that have promotion potential to higher grade levels. A very large number of employees are hired that way in the federal government. They're great opportunities to come in at an entry level at a GS-7 or a GS-9 and move very rapidly up to a GS-11 or 12-level position. It's also important to note when you look at intern programs like that, that intern doesn't equal 22 years old. At the Defense Logistics Agency, where I was employed until I was appointed to this position, we had about 800 people in our corporate intern program at any given time in an agency of 23,000. The average age of those interns was about 37 years old. So internships are a good option for people who are 30 years old, 40 years old, looking to make a career change. It's a great way to move into another position. So you don't have to be a very young person to go into an internship. You can have some gray hair or no hair at all and go into one.
Look, I want to just add just a quick plug that the partnership put out a report on internships about 2 months ago, focusing, and we're talking to some of the most forward-thinking HR chiefs right here. But truth be told, right now, that's a place also where the federal government has a lot of work to do. Of the interns that can count, it converts 7% into full-time employees. That number ought to be closer to 50%. And what has happened is there are some agencies that see internships as part of their talent pipeline, ought to be, in fact, their most consequential part of their entry level. When I say interns, I'm talking student interns here. But for many agencies, they're not quite there yet, and they actually need to get to the point where they're using the internship as a talent strategy process, as opposed to simply seeing them as part-time help or in many instances simply a friends and family program for the agency. And honestly, that's a real problem. And I'm blunt on purpose, because I think if we change anything right now, if we simply made that process work right, we'd be fixing a whole lot. There's a lot of work to be done there, but I'm seeing lots of signs. And I commend to all of you to take a look at the report, because I think it really outlines a lot of strategies about what's possible. And you heard from this panel all the reasons why you want to do it. Can't assess better than actually having an opportunity to work with somebody. Can't have a better ambassador than someone who's worked with you and then is a peer-to-peer connection on the various campuses. We have a program called the Student Ambassador Program, where we train folks who have been interns in the federal government the HR information that they need to know so they can be peer-to-peer ambassadors for the federal government when they return to their campus. And that's a really, I think, wonderful model, very cost-effective and very effective. Final question we have back here.
I'm Joel Reeser with the National Older Worker Career Center. I just wondered what innovative programs you're putting in place in order to continue to tap the skill and knowledge of retirees once they retire.
Well, we have actually, Treasury has actually been working with the partnership on what's called the Fed Experience Project. And it was specifically an effort to reach out to retired or soon-to-be retired individuals to encourage them and assist them in identifying job opportunities in the federal government and in particular in Treasury. We have it's, I guess, now been about a year that we've been working this. But it is very important that we're able to reach out and assist folks, encourage folks who are thinking about a second career to come to Treasury. We need to be recruiting at all levels, not just entry level. The gaps that we need to fill as folks retire or be in order to address new mission needs need to be at experience levels as well as entry level. We hope that our efforts in the Fed Experience Project in doing direct contact with the IBM was the organization that we worked with essentially as a pilot, but we hope it can be replicated in their working with their soon-to-be-retired folks in identifying opportunities post-retirement. So we are very focused on that.
Great. Listen, a big round of applause to Rochelle and Jeff. They have a hard road ahead of them, but it's going to be a road that's going to make it a lot better for all of us. So thank you again. Thank you all for coming here. Go to the website, give us your feedback, and very, very thanks for being here.